Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Erin Bosch and I'm co-chair of the membership committee with Heidi Hughes. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, abilities, or inabilities. Later in the service, we will invite any people here for the first or second time to introduce themselves if they wish to. We don't require it, but we like it. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or our part-time minister, Sandra Ingham. This morning, it will be a member of our own community, Johanna Hatch, who I do not see. Oh, there she is. Okay. Thank goodness. I thought she left. That would not be good. Now I welcome Patty and Mary to come and light the chalice for us.
The light of life shines through the eyes of each and every person. The light of truth shines through each life. May the light of this chalice remind us that our search for truth and light is ongoing as enhanced and nurtured by every person we meet. May we honor the light in each other. Reverend Jill McAllister, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations.
This morning, our presentation is by Johanna Hatch. I was not given any bio to introduce Johanna, so I hope she will tell us a little about herself, but I happen to know that before she came to Prairie, she was very much involved with getting women more equal treatment, et cetera, in the Catholic Church. So I hope, give us a little bio, Johanna.
Well, first I just want to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to the this community again. Around this time last year, I was able to speak kind of a reflection on 1 year with Pope Francis as the leader of the Roman Catholic Church and some of my reflections on that as a progressive and a feminist and somebody who's come out of the Catholic Church. So just a quick bio about myself. Like Erin mentioned, I am the past president of the Board of Directors for Women's Ordination Conference, which is the oldest and largest organization that advocates for women's equality in the Catholic Church. I stepped down from that position this past summer when I was about 36 weeks pregnant with Aurora because my life was just a little too full for that. And I'm still kind of trying to figure out what is a good relationship for me to have with the institution of the Roman Catholic Church, because there's a lot of stuff in there that I think is really hurtful to a lot of people, and I think there's many folks in this community who have come out of that tradition and who have come out of other religious traditions where women's contributions and roles are very limited, and they know the harm that that can cause. And as I was preparing this presentation for you today, I wanted to dedicate this to a friend of mine whose name is Maggie, and I'm going to get a little emotional. She is was a sister of St. Joseph of Carondelet in St. Paul. She was my friend. She was my mentor. She was the definition of a wise woman. And once when I was visiting with her in her home, she had hanging up this teal stole. It was just kind of like draped over a door, and I asked her about it, and her response to me was that in the 80s, she went to one of the first conferences on women's ordination, sponsored by Women's Ordination Conference, and the stole in the Catholic tradition is really the sign of the ordained priesthood, and she said, that has been hanging there since I was there, and it will continue to hang there until my church recognizes my call to ministry. And if they don't before I die, I want to be buried with it. And About 2 weeks ago, I found out that she had gone into hospice, and she was too weak to receive visitors or even calls or cards, so I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to her. And she passed away on February 28th. And it really kind of opened this up for me again in a new way, because I know that she was buried with that stole, because an institution that she committed her life to as a nun never recognized the gifts that she had to bring to her community. And I know that she suffered for it. So what is Equal in Faith? And I just want to talk a little bit about this. Equal in Faith is a global interfaith action that was started in 2013 that is really a call to action for gender equity, both in religious communities and in society at large. It was inaugurated 2 years ago on this day, International Women's Day, with representatives from the Roman Catholic tradition, from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormon tradition, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, as well as Muslim women, and women from the Jewish tradition. So they really wanted to intentionally be an interfaith movement to say that across our traditions, we believe that discrimination against women is wrong. So participants gathered to fast for a day and to pray together for their religious communities to repent of the sin of sexism, which is really most plainly illustrated by the exclusion of women from ordained ministry or for positions of leadership and places of prayer. Specifically, the Jewish women who are part of this movement are representatives of what's called Women at the Wall, which is a movement that wants the equal opportunity for Jewish women to be able to pray out loud, read from the Torah, and wear prayer shawls at the Western Wall of the Temple in Jerusalem. Women who attempt to do this are dragged away and arrested. So even traditions that we see in the United States may have a strong example of women's equality and women's leadership, particularly in the Reform Jewish movement, there are still parts of that tradition that really struggle with women's equality. And especially also for Muslim women who tend to, in their spaces of prayer, actually be physically separated from the men. And the men get to be on the main floor to pray, and the women are sometimes in the back behind a screen or in a balcony so that they can't fully participate. And I think this is, especially for a community like ours, it's really like, this should be a really simple concept. It's 2015. We know that for many traditions still, the implementation of women's equality is literally heretical. It is a heresy. It is an excommunicable offense. So for folks who heard my presentation around this time last year, I talked a little bit about Father Roy Bourgeois, who is a Mary Knoll priest, or was a Mary Knoll priest. He is the founder of the School of the Americas Watch, so he has a long tradition of working for social justice and equality, and he was stripped of his ministry, removed from his order, lost his home, lost his source of support because he doesn't really get a lot of income being an activist, because he participated in the illicit ordination of a woman to the priesthood and refused to repent. That was really the kind of the crux of the excommunication, is he said, no, I can't say that I don't believe in this. If he had just said, oh, I made a mistake, I don't believe in it, the church would have welcomed him back. But because he said, no, I believe women are equal and should be recognized as such in our church, that was worth stripping him of ministry. And since then, within the past year, this was in the news a little bit, Kate Kelly, who is the founder of a movement called Ordained Women in the Mormon Church, has also been excommunicated for the same thing. She refuses to recant of her belief that women should equally have the right to hold the priesthood in the Mormon tradition. And in their tradition, pretty much any adult man in good standing fulfills the role of the priesthood for his family. And he does things like baptize their children. He can provide blessings and prayers and sacraments. And because she said, you know, no, like I truly believe that women should have that capacity within their families as well, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints saw fit to excommunicate her, which means she cannot participate in the prayer life of her community, which she's been a member of her entire life. So I just want us all to consider for a moment how radical and disruptive gender equality has to be if an institution's response is to remove someone who refuses to be quiet about it. If that's the only appropriate response, how disruptive and how transformative gender equality really is. And one question I reflected on today as well is, what is the value of such a movement? Particularly for folks like us who are in a progressive tradition, folks in secular society, you know, why should we care about women striving for equality in these institutions that really are not very responsive to that? And I say that it's really, at its most basic, this movement matters because women matter, and because women's lives matter. And as we're on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Selma, I recall his words that he famously said, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. If we truly believe that gender equality is a moral imperative, and I do, it's probably my driving moral imperative, then any institution that denies the very basic idea has to be challenged. It doesn't matter if it's a religious organization, if it's a governmental organization, if it's a way of moving in the world, we have to challenge that. And I think one of the really important functions of Equal in Faith is that it can serve to reach both people who are inside of those traditions that oppose women's equality, and people who are outside of those traditions as well, and to raise awareness about the impact of religiously based sexism on society at large. And the fact also, I think it's also really important to highlight that a movement like this can bring to light that no religion, however we may view it from the outside, is monolithic. So just kind of referencing the last time I was able to present here, you know, we have this image, or the media has presented this image of Pope Francis as very progressive. And you know, many commentators are convinced that rapid change is happening in the Catholic Church. But even within the last few months, Pope Francis has compared gender studies theory, or you know, more progressive ideas about gender, he's compared it to the Nazi youth, and I'm not even kidding about that, as well as accused people with progressive notions of gender of cultural colonialism and trying to change societies for, like, in the movement for gender equality. Pretty soon after that, he also declared that people who choose to not have children are selfish, and don't think that I missed the irony on that coming from the Pope. So sexism is obviously still rampant. And I speak from the Catholic tradition because, like I said, that's the tradition of my origin, and that's really where I was engaged in a lot of my activism. So it's just where I have the most prescient examples. So Catholic feminists and progressives are some of the few voices that are making sure that stories like this don't get lost in the shuffle when we're talking about, you know, oh, this great Pope, he's so progressive, and he does say some nice things and do some nice things, but we can't give him a free pass on these very obviously backwards, frankly, ideas about gender and women's equality. And I think these stories also really need to be told so that we can no longer write off, so we can't write off everyone who claims a tradition as passively agreeing with sexist teachings. There are many dissenting voices in these communities, and by lifting up these dissenting voices, I think it serves to reduce the power that these institutions have over both their individual members and their influence over society at large. So another question that I also reflected on, now that I am a member of a Unitarian Universalist community and I no longer attend Catholic churches and I don't receive communion out of a personal choice, is, you know, well, why don't they just leave? And I got asked that question a lot when I was a more visible activist in the progressive Catholic community. And, you know, I think it's a good question, and it's very true that in our pluralistic society, we do have the option of walking away from a religious tradition. And it's, you know, don't think that every Catholic or Mormon or whatever tradition feminist hasn't already considered this, and possibly hasn't already attempted this. Women in these traditions really intimately know the power that these traditions have over the lives of women in their communities. and they understand the fear that silences many women who don't want to lose their connection to their heritage or to their families. Because we know that by speaking too loudly or too forcefully, you can be cut off from for what many people is a very important part of their lives. And at the same time, there's also this tension because many, including myself, credit their religious tradition with being the very first thing that instilled in them a sense of justice and a drive to work for justice. And it's really difficult to divorce those things. This is where I learned about justice and equality, and why isn't it happening here? And so to simply leave without at least trying to change their tradition really can feel like abandonment. It can really feel like, you know, I haven't done everything I can do for the other women in my community and for my children. And another question that I reflected on and I really want to spend some time on here is, so what? Why does it matter to a progressive community like Prairie? And I really believe that the continued subjugation of women in religious communities touches far more than those individual women in those communities. You know, these patriarchal beliefs about women really contribute to the creation of strict gender roles, which I also believe is part of the root of homophobia and transphobia, very strict ideas about what women and also what men can and can't do. And when these beliefs are held as religious truths, those who feel morally compelled to enforce them, not only for adherence to their own faith, but they also feel compelled to bring those to society at large. Because, you know, if this is the divine plan and this is truth, why shouldn't it be universal? For instance, when policymakers hold these values and are elected to positions of power, they will use those positions to try to further their visions of women, sexuality, and the family onto society at large. And I have often said this in the past, that feminists and our allies ignore the Roman Catholic Church to our peril. The US bishops have long been advocates for further restrictions on reproductive rights and restrictions on legal protections for LGBT people. And I would argue that these positions stem directly from their view of the role of women as shaped by their religious tradition. Additionally, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, along with the Catholic Church, was one of the main funders of the successful Proposition 8 campaign in California, which for some time revoked marriage equality in that state. So traditions that have these very strict views of women have no compunction about trying to enforce their beliefs about gender, about sexuality, and family on the rest of us who don't share those beliefs, who would be perfectly happy to let them practice what they believe in their traditions, you know, and kind of live and let live. We don't receive that same politeness, for lack of a better word. And we know that any institution that denies women equal access to decision making, whether it's religious or secular, cannot adequately represent its female members. But that in no way stops them from making some pretty serious decisions about women's lives. The Catholic Church's opposition to birth control is not just an archaic teaching that actually is ignored by at least the majority of its United States members. It's something like 98% of Catholic women have used a non-church approved form of birth control at some point in their lives. It is an archaic teaching that is being ignored. It is a policy that the Catholic hierarchy holds as divinely inspired, and then it uses its influence as an observer member at the United Nations to insert itself into global human rights discussions that impact women's ability to access reproductive health care. And they have no problem aligning themselves with other religious states, including Iran, to impose that will on the bodies of women. And then they have the audacity to call it the will of God. And like I said before, you know, I use the Catholic Church as an example a lot because it's where I'm from, it's what I know, but I think it can give you a picture of how religious institutions can really have a powerful impact on society at large and why what happens in those institutions and the beliefs that they hold and the way that they treat women really can have a direct impact on the lives of women who are not part of those traditions. And, you know, I also think the fact that patriarchy and this drive to preserve patriarchy is such a common factor in many religious traditions. I think it speaks to something much larger than just those individual religious traditions. I think it's a larger problem that we have to address, and I certainly don't have time today to smash the patriarchy in totality, but religious institutions are one of the strongest holdouts of this belief. I think what I'm trying to say here is because it's not just religion, but it certainly is highlighted in religion, it has to be challenged anywhere and everywhere it arises, and that includes other religious traditions, which is something that can be really uncomfortable, I think, especially for people who believe in the good of a pluralistic society and the rights of people to, you know, decide for themselves what they want to believe, and, you know, what churches they want to belong to and how they want to do that. So what is our responsibility as allies? And I hope that I am not overstepping my bounds by saying that I hope everyone here is an ally of feminism and an ally of, you know, progressive movements within religion. And I think that one of the most important things we can do as a liberal religious community that values gender equality is really to make sure that in both our language and our action, we do not allow religion to be an excuse for the subjugation of women. And like I said, I understand this can be a really difficult topic to navigate, and we don't want to denigrate another person's religious faith or religious expression. But if we give sexism a free pass because it's done in the name of God or a God, we are kind of implicitly stating that there are certain situations in which it is perfectly fine to subjugate women, and that gender equality is not an absolute right. And if we are willing to budge on the dignity of women in some circumstances, then what precludes us from budging in other circumstances? And I understand that this may seem like a rather dramatic way to put it, but I really do believe that this attitude does contribute to gender equality being seen as a less important or less urgent movement in our society. I think it's also really important that we are able to lift up the voices of those who call for change in their own traditions. And I think it's a very appropriate thing to do. Equal in faith is at least part of the vision of the board of directors of the Women's Ordination Conference. And I remember the meeting where we started to have this idea of, you know, we're feminists, we're kind of rooted in the Catholic tradition, but there has to be other people in other traditions who feel this way about their churches and their communities. And what if we got together with them? How much more powerful could our voice be if across diverse religious traditions we were able to say that, you know, say no to the subjugation of women? And we also knew that other traditions could offer potential roadmaps forward, especially those traditions such as Unitarian Universalism that have really embraced women's leadership. And we hoped that feminists who loved their own traditions would be willing to stand in solidarity with women in the Catholic Church, in the Mormon Church, in the Lutheran Church of the Missouri Synod, to stand with women in those churches and say, put an end to sexism and discrimination. And I really think one of the greatest strengths of Unitarian Universalism is that we can offer this unconditional welcome. So we hear every week here, you are welcome no matter your age, your ability, your religious beliefs, your spiritual journey. That hospitality has, you know, played out in many different ways for women coming from traditions that do not value them. Sometimes in very quiet ways, when we sneak in the back, and maybe hang out a couple weeks and see if this is a good home for us, but also in very concrete ways, such as being a hospitable place to hold an illicit ordination for people who are directly challenging the teachings of their church. Numerous Unitarian Universalist congregations have been the home to both women who are ordained illicitly in the Catholic tradition, as well as congregations that spring up in multiple traditions that want to have equal leadership with men and women. We've been really grateful that the leaders of those congregations have been willing to stand up to the Catholic bishops in their diocese who say, well, we aren't going to work with you anymore if you provide refuge for these heretics. And the Unitarian Universalists have time and again said, well, sorry then. You know, we're gonna provide a space for these people because it's part of what we value. And that's really, really powerful. It's a really powerful thing that we as a community and as a larger tradition have to offer. And finally, I think we also can really provide an alternative vision of the role of women in religion. And if you look back not too far into our own tradition, you can find the Universalist minister Olympia Brown. And Olympia has the distinction of being both the first woman in the United States to graduate from seminary, as well as the first woman in the United States to be ordained to ministry in 1863. It's actually not that long ago. And because of her relentless drive for education and equality, she was also a suffragist. In the pursuit of her call to ministry, we can trace a lineage that goes all the way from her to our own minister here. On the 100th anniversary of her ordination, her alma mater, the theological school at St. Lawrence University, which is now, I think her seminary there is actually defunct, but they do still do theological studies there, they placed a plaque at a church that she pastored in Racine with the inscription, "The flame of her spirit still burns today." Indeed, that flame burns on in all women, like my friend Maggie, who refused to accept the status quo, and like Olympia, who challenged the notion that because it always has been, it always shall be so. Olympia's legacy is that the hopes and dreams of the Equal in Faith campaign are not in vain. Indeed, our tradition illustrates that religious institutions can and do change and evolve to meet the needs of the times and the places that they find themselves in. And it is my hope that her example can inspire the actions of the Equal in Faith campaigners as they struggle toward a vision of gender justice for all. And I hope that she also inspires us to be allies for those who struggle to change their traditions just like she did. Thank you. I don't think there's a lot going on in Madison, unfortunately, besides me talking here today. For Equal in Faith specifically, you can go to equalinfaith.org, so pretty easy to remember. I know that in Madison there are some progressive Catholics that continue to work for change in the church. There's groups like Call to Action, and I would definitely be happy to talk with you more afterwards about what you can find here in Madison. I am a huge cynic about Pope Francis, so I will preface my words with that. And I know I also heard that about the LDS Church, and I'm also not exactly sure what that's going to mean for LGBT people who identify with that faith community. But I will say for Pope Francis, I think that there is a huge hunger for people who are both in the Catholic Church and people who have left the Catholic Church for progressive change. And a lot of people just are very excited to kind of latch on to any shred of what looks like good news. And I also think Pope Francis is a really great PR move for the Catholic Church because he's very good at getting good press. But I think we have to look deeper at the words, the things that he says, and look at if that's actually having an influence on the actual nuts and bolts and teachings of the Catholic Church. Because a pope can say a lot of things, but that doesn't actually make any change happen on the way down. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it does create a loop of kind of a positive feedback loop for more progressive change, or if it's kind of a smokescreen. I lean towards the smokescreen. Say just briefly about that I know it is tricky for many women of my generation or younger women to to call themselves feminists for whatever reason. But I think part of it should actually be a credit to the women who have gone before us, that they have made gender equality such an expectation that it's like fluoride. It's in our water. We don't even know that it's there. So thank you to the generations that have made it possible for us to be so blasé about it. But I think that's also even more impetus for me to not put the flag down. Also a great opportunity for me to plug, if anybody's curious about non-canonical sisters, we have one of the two non-canonical women's religious communities in the country here in Madison, Benedictine Women of Madison. They are not part of the Roman Catholic Church, but they're still nuns, so it's very interesting if you're ever curious about that. Well, I think, so with the Jewish tradition, there is really, I think, a lot of variance, just like there is if you look at Christianity at large. Like Reform and Reconstructionist movements have female rabbis, they're very active in struggles for equality. The National Council of Jewish Women is a very progressive organization. They do a lot of work around reproductive rights and social justice. However, if you look at the Orthodox tradition, very similar to the Catholic tradition, there are very, very many restrictions on women. Including what women may wear, you know, how women and men may socialize together, that has led to violence. Especially, there are occasionally stories out of Israel of women being attacked for, you know, getting on the wrong bus with men. For women, you know, and then like Women at the Wall, who's one of the founding organizations of the Equal in Faith movement, you know, when women try to read from the Torah at the Western Wall, they are literally dragged away. I mean, ganged up on by groups of men and dragged away just for reading from the Torah out loud. So there's, like many, like all of our religious traditions, there's a huge spectrum. And then as for equal pay for equal work, yeah, we are still pretty bad. But I think all these struggles for women's, I think that just shows how pervasive women's inequality still is throughout our secular society and religious traditions, and how intimately tied our views on women are kind of across that spectrum. You know, like Rosemary said, women's rights are human rights. Nobody gets a free pass because they say their God says that it's okay to treat women that way. And you know, how many different ways can we kind of attack that perspective to say that, you know, no, you don't get to do that just because you say that that's part of your religious tradition. Like that woman has the right to life and the right to liberty and the right to determine the course of her own life, regardless of whether or not she identifies herself as Muslim or non-religious.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Welcome Johanna back for the closing words.
Councils by Marge Piercy. We must sit down and reason together. We must sit down. Men standing want to hold forth. They rain down upon faces lifted. We must sit down on the floor, on the earth, on stones and mats and blankets. There must be no front to the speaking, no platform, no rostrum, no stage or table. We will not crane to see who is speaking. Perhaps we should sit in the dark. In the dark, we could utter our feelings. In the dark, we could propose and describe and suggest. In the dark, we could not see who speaks, and only the words would say what they say. Thus saying what we feel and what we want, what we fear for ourselves and each other. Into the dark, perhaps we could begin to listen. Perhaps we should talk in groups small enough for everyone to speak. Perhaps we should start by speaking softly. The women must learn to dare to speak. The men must bother to listen. The women must learn to say, I think this is so. The men must learn to stop dancing solos on the ceiling. After each speaks, she or he will repeat a ritual phrase. It is not I who speaks, but the wind. Wind blows through me. Long after me is the wind.
Okay, so we just now would like to suggest that you greet your neighbor and discuss some more. And somebody needs to ask those people how Johanna publicized this, that they showed up this morning, because we're interested in that. Okay.